You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, the owners, caretakers and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast. Oh, yeah. Alternative news, analysis, and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m.
Only double. Grab your pants.
Good morning, and you're listening to Tuesday Breakfast on the Tuesday, 29th of July, 2025 on 8:55 a.m. And we want to say a big thank you to the Radioactive Show, which is 3CR's national nuclear program on nuclear peace and energy issues. In the studio today with me, we've got Fiza. Good morning.
Morning, Juliet. How are you?
I'm good. Well, it's great to have you back after a big trip last week.
I still feel like I'm in the car. Am I still in Canberra? It was good. It was a long drive, but it was meaningful. It was good to see interstate solidarity as well. I thought that was really nice to actually see people from other states and, you know, how, what kind of stuff they've been up to in terms of, protesting and resisting. So, it was good.
It sounded like such a, amazing moment of, like, information sharing solidarity across so many different places.
Absolutely, And, like, really good speeches. Like, we had a lot of good speakers from, and again, across the state. So, that was good because, after a while, you do end up hearing the same people from within the state. So, it was nice to be able to hear voices from other parts of the continent. So, that was good.
No, really great to hear about your time at the Convergence on Canberra. So thanks for telling us about it, Fiza. And I actually heard a very interesting quote yesterday about Melbourne winter, to put a positive spin on it. Is that in Melbourne we have very European weather, so you can layer and be chic. So
I don't know about being chic. You saw me this morning. I walk in a giant puffer jacket that just hides all sins. It's just, I just want to literally wear my doona out and that's it.
I have this one puffer jacket, which I don't really wear very much anymore, but it's, basically like a sleeping bag.
Yeah, exactly. That's it. Like, I wore my sleeping bag out and I'm like, it's fine. It's too dark. Nobody can see anything.
Exactly. We've certainly got a big show today. Poor Fung is at home sick, but she's actually, despite that, going to be helping out remotely today.
Soldiering, absolutely.
Yeah, which is really awesome. So, I think at 7:15, Fung's going to be speaking to Annette Brownlee, who's one of the founding members of the Brisbane-based community peace organisation Just Peace Queensland and a current chairperson of IPAN. Annette will be on the show to talk about the Talisman Sabre War exercise designed by Australia and the US. And then at 7:30, we've got Claire Hansen from the Save Public Housing Collective, who's going to update the very concerning situation with the demolition and destruction of public housing towers across Melbourne.
At 7:45, we'll have my interview with S, one of the organisers of the Visit Palestine Post exhibition, which will be opening this Friday, 1st of August, at the Black Spark Cultural Centre.
Yeah, and then we'll have Fleur Taylor, who's from the Save Our Pool campaign in Banyule Council. And Fleur's going to be joining us to chat about the importance of community pools, particularly in light of National Drowning Day, which was last week. And then finally, we're going to be speaking to Janae Dodd, who is a proud Gungaru Biddy Widdy and Kanju woman, who's going to be talking to us about the Yumba Balbara Badi camp in central Queensland, which is resisting the Gemini coal mine. So, we've certainly got a massive show for you guys today.
Incredible. Some folks know about it, some don't.
listening to Tuesday Breakfast, and it's the 29th of July 2025, and these are the news headlines. So the National Network of Incarcerated and Formerly Incarcerated Women and Girls has responded to the Northern Territory's government's proposed overhaul of the Youth Justice Act 2005 and Youth Justice Regulations 2006. These proposed changes represent a punitive attack on the rights, dignity and lives of children in the Northern Territory, said Debbie Kilroy, founder of the National Network. The key changes will be tabled and will include for courts to now consider a young person's full criminal history when sentencing for adult offences, removing detention as a last resort, and stronger powers for youth justice officers to use spit guards. In response to this, Debbie states, the removal of detention as a last resort, the introduction of spit hoods, and the use of a child's full criminal history in sentencing are regressive, harmful, and dangerous. These changes will not keep the community safe. They will result in more harm, more trauma, and more deaths in custody. Tabitha Lean, also from the National Network, has said, "The National Network rejects the narrative that justice must be cruel to be effective. We reject reforms that criminalise trauma, deepen inequality, and shred human rights. We call for the urgent withdrawal of this legislation and a complete halt to this escalating war on children." And for more information, you can head to thenationalnetwork.com.au.
Also in the news, at least 35 people have been killed and more than 270,000 displaced by the worst fighting in over a decade between Thailand and Cambodia. Clashes continued early on Monday, just hours before negotiations were due to begin in Kuala Lumpur. Malaysia is the current chair of the regional bloc ASEAN and has also been calling for an end to the fighting. Thailand and Cambodia have a long-running dispute over territory on their shared border dating back more than a century when the borders of the two nations were drawn after the French occupation of Cambodia. The latest tensions ramped up in May after a Cambodian soldier was killed in a clash. Further fighting erupted last Thursday after Thai soldiers were injured in a landmine explosion. Both have recalled their ambassadors and Thailand closed its border crossing with Cambodia, downgrading diplomatic relations. The conflict has also led to a rise in nationalism in both countries, prompting Thai officials to warn its citizens to refrain from any kind of violence in speech or action against Cambodian migrants living in the country. The dispute has been complicated by a feud between two senior political figures from both countries, Hun Sen, the former leader of Cambodia and father of current Prime Minister, and Thaksin Shinawatra, former Thai leader and father of current Prime Minister. Pathong Tham is currently suspended from office after Hun Sen leaked a recording of a controversial phone call he held with her. It is not clear why he leaked the call, but it has caused outrage in Thailand and underlined the extent of the falling out between the two families. Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders peoples should note this segment contains mention of people who have passed away. In other news this week, on Monday, 28 July 2025, the coroner handed down their findings into the passing of Heather Calgary. Heather was a proud Yamachi, Noongar, Wongi and Pijan Jaya woman and artist, a mother, sister, daughter, cousin and a rock for her family. Following an inquest, Coroner Sarah Gerbert delivered a 300-page finding which declared Heather Calgary's death in custody was preventable and her health in prison had deteriorated from the moment her baby was removed from her at birth. Heather had been 6 months pregnant when she arrived at Dame Phyllis Frost Women's Prison in July 2019. Ms. Calgary has described the removal of her daughter as hell and the incident was a pivotal moment in her overall health decline while in custody. She experienced depression, grief, shame and trauma from the removal and separation from her three other children. Ms. Calgary pleaded to be released on parole about 6 months before her death, writing a letter expressing frustration as one of her parole conditions was to complete a program that was not available at the Dame Phyllis Frost Women's Prison. Outside court, Heather's sister Suzanne welcomed the findings but said it should not have taken her sister's death for changes to be made to the prison system. Earlier this month, a rally was held to demand an end to human rights abuses at Dame Phyllis Frost Centre. And finally, in the headlines, the UN says Israel has eased some restrictions in Gaza, allowing 100 truckloads of aid to be collected, but warns the amount is not enough to stave off famine and a catastrophic health crisis. Authorities in Gaza say 6 more Palestinians have starved to death, bringing the total toll of deaths from hunger to 133 since the genocide began. One of them is an infant named Muhammad Ibrahim Adas, who died due to malnutrition and shortage of baby formula. The government media office says Gaza needs 600 trucks of aid per day and 250,000 cans of baby formula per month to meet the minimum needs of its starving population. It said the urgent solution was to break the Israeli blockade and open the crossings unconditionally. On Sunday, the Israeli army said it would temporarily halt military activity from 10 a.m. to 8 p.m. daily in parts of central and northern Gaza. It also pledged to open designated aid corridors for food and medical convoys between 6 a.m. and 11 p.m. Despite this, Israeli forces continue to shoot at aid seekers in Gaza. Over the weekend, thousands of protesters across the world took to the streets banging pots and pans to draw attention to Israel's deliberate starvation of Palestinians. In Naam, also called Melbourne, the weekly Sunday rally for Palestine ended their march at the National Gallery of Victoria, or NGV, which recently announced the renaming of the Great Hall to Gandel Hall after the Zionist Gandel Foundation, who are founding donors of the gallery. These have been the news headlines for Tuesday, 29th July, 2025. You're listening to 3CR Breakfast on 855 AM.
3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings. Cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au.
Women on the Line, a radical intersectional current affairs program.
Making space for the voices of women and gender diverse people.
Featuring in-depth conversations with guests from so-called Australia and beyond.
Ultimately, we're looking to care for country, to continue our culture, to continue our ceremonies, so that our children have a strong sense of self and belonging.
Just because our marginalisation intersect where we're both disabled, it doesn't change your white privilege. It doesn't change your straight privilege. It doesn't change your able-bodied privilege.
Sex work, the word itself, has been such a word with a lot of stigma. However, we cannot ignore that there are women out there who are making their livelihood out of this job.
Listen every Monday morning at 8:30 on 3CR Community Radio, 855 AM, or stream live on 3cr.org.au.
Love podcasts? We've got you. Find Women on the Line via the Community Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Women on the Line, where about?
Feminisms in their multitudes.
First Nations sovereignty.
Land back.
Trans liberation. Poo-poo on the turfs.
Abolition.
Anti-racism.
Sex worker rights.
South liberation.
Disability justice.
Anti-imperialism.
Decolonisation.
An end to borders.
Workers' justice.
And so much more.
Women on the Line, broadcasting on the 3CR airwaves since 1986. Woo! Woo! Woo!
The Victorian state government is planning repressive new laws to restrict protest, including bans on protective masks and lock-on devices, increased police search powers, restrictions on symbols of resistance such as flags, and creation of so-called safe zones around religious buildings, putting significant areas of the CBD off limits. We must say no to this attack on democracy. Protest is a fundamental human right. Join the fight to defend it at a mass rally hosted by Defend Dissent Coalition on Tuesday, 12th of August, 5:30 p.m. at Parliament House. Defend Dissent Coalition is a 3CR supporter.
You're listening to Tuesday Breakfast, and we're now going to cross to Fung, who is joining us remotely.
Thanks so much, Juliet. We are joined on the phone this morning by Annette Brownlee, who is a founding member of the Brisbane-based community peace organisation Just Peace Queensland and the current and inaugural chairperson of IPAN. She has served in this position for over a decade. Annette is on the show this morning to tell us more about Talisman Sabre War exercises designed by Australia and the US, now in its 11th iteration. We will also be speaking about the upcoming Pacific Peace Conference taking place in Brisbane at the end of the week. Welcome to 3CR Breakfast, Annette.
Oh, hi, Fong, and it's lovely to talk on your radio show. Thank you for asking me to talk about Talisman Sabre and other matters. Yeah.
Thanks, Annette. I was wondering if you could start by telling us more about Talisman Sabre and how it started.
Yeah, well, as you say, it's the 11th iteration of Talisman Sabre. It is its 20th year, so it started in 2005. And some of us in Brisbane organised a protest at that very first Talisman Sabre exercise. That was the small one, but it did grow to a very large 1,000-person protest in 2007. And, you know, we have known the purpose of Talisman Sabre right from the beginning. You know, it's putting Australia on a war footing, and as is AUKUS. So, you know, that's how we view this Talisman Sabre exercise, the largest ever, with more than 35,000 personnel from 19 different countries with the most sophisticated weaponry systems that are being trialled all across the north of Australia. You know, the bulk of it happens at Shoalwater Bay, but it's expanded right through the Northern Territory and into parts of Western Australia as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks for that, Annette. We were saying just before or just now that it's running this year for the 11th time. What can you tell us about this latest iteration of these war exercises, including, you know, the current context that they're being run in? So you mentioned AUKUS just before. We've got increased militarisation across the country. So, yeah, what are your reflections on this year's running of it in terms of the broader context?
Yeah, and that's how we need to look at it. And as I said, you know, from the Pacific pivot onwards in 2011, really, we have been placed on a war footing. Talisman Sabre has increased in size and the type of weaponry that's being experimented with. You've probably seen on the television the first use of long-range missiles that can travel 5,000 kilometres. It still doesn't get you to China, and you've got to wonder, well, what is this all about? They are using the HIMAR, which is a mobile system. I believe that they conducted these missile tests on Christmas Island. I mean, you know, it's terrible to think that these exercises are happening on pristine lands, whether it's Central Australia, North Australia, Western Queensland, or Christmas Island, or these are pristine lands, Aboriginal lands that are being impacted by these incredibly destructive weapons systems. And there has been very little actual coverage of what is going on during Talisman Sabre. In fact, you know, they've conducted these at locations, just including Papua New Guinea, you may have read about as well this year. So the context is, of course, this build-up to war against China, and this is where AUKUS fits in. It's where the AUKMIN talks fit in that have been conducted in Australia, the Australia-UK annual talks, where many of your listeners will have heard that Australia has signed a 50-year treaty with the United Kingdom to continue to work on AUKUS Pillar 1, which is the submarines. But also, it provides in this treaty provision for United Kingdom astute class, a nuclear-powered attack submarines to berth in ports around Australia. So mm-hmm. it's, you know, it's just sort of locking in what we have already locked in with the United States. And I think it's interesting, really, that this treaty, so-called Geelong Treaty, I mean, excuse me while I feel a bit more, a bit nauseous, that Richard Marles has managed to get the treaty named over the city that he has his offices in. I mean, the ego and is just sickening, yeah.
Mm.
But, you know, this treaty really says to me that there's at least some doubt in the minds of the government that the United States is going to be there for this AUKUS pact and that they're hedging their bets by going back to Britain, you know, Britain that let us down in the Second World War, that we said we can no longer rely on Britain. We've got to go to the United States. And now we are swinging back from the United States to Britain. I mean, it's kind of really ridiculous. Yeah.
Yeah. And you were saying just now that there's been very little reporting on this, and it's been interesting to see, you know, even doing a bit of research on Talisman Sabre, the type of language that is being used to talk about it. I mean, it's, you know, it's being called the Olympics of war games. So even the language that's used to talk about it says a lot about, the perspectives that people are taking on this. But I wanted to ask you about the upcoming Pacific Peace Conference that will cover a broad range of issues, including things like not just Talisman Sabre, but also the 80th anniversary of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and also, you know, those Pacific nations you mentioned before who are at the front line of not only climate catastrophes, but rising militarism and more. How do you connect all of these issues, Annette, and why is it so important for people to come together to discuss these important issues?
Thanks very much for that question, Fung. It is really important that we network with our regional activists and neighbours. There's lots of reasons. I think the conference itself is an opportunity to listen, learn and network and develop relationships, which are necessary if we're going to build a movement throughout the Pacific. And Australia is a Pacific Rim country. I'm sure that Pacific peoples in the islands that are, you know, that live in the Pacific Ocean, see themselves as being different to the Pacific Rim countries. America is a Pacific Rim country, but Australia has a long history of engagement in the Pacific and the Pacific Islands Forum, which is held every year. But marrying those issues, I think, sits well with Pacific people. They are the ones that have experienced the Second World War. They are the ones that experienced the above-ground tests throughout the 50s, 60s, up to the 70s. In fact, I think France was still conducting tests in the Pacific, you know, as have our First Nations people with the British tests. So there are things that really do bring us together. And the pursuit of a nuclear-free, independent and ecologically stable Pacific is in all of our interests. And we've tried to bring those issues all together at the conference with the geopolitical situation, the context of what's happening in the world, which does include a focus on what's happening in Gaza and for Palestinians. Senator David Shoebridge will be speaking at that session, in the first session of the day. And we've got some wonderful Pacific speakers the Vanuatu Climate Change Minister, Ralph Reginbanu, who has been on the news here just in the last week talking about that amazing win that the Vanuatu young people had in the ICJ. We have a speaker from the Northern Marianas, Sheila Babuatu. Also, the Northern Marianas is having airstrips refreshed, ready for this war against China, as is, you know, parts of other countries like the Philippines and Guam. Yeah, so, you know, these are all important issues that all have connections. And that's really what we aim to do at the conference.
Yeah, thank you so much for that, Annette. And unfortunately, that's all we have time for this morning, but I'd love to speak with you again after the conference, just so that, you know, you can reflect on what was discussed throughout the conference and again, like, link together all these important issues when it comes to climate, you know, getting rid of nuclear and fighting against, you know, rising militarisation, not just here in so-called Australia, but in the Pacific as well. But, yeah, for now, thank you so much for joining us on the show this morning.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me as a representative of IPAN to speak with your listeners. Thank you very much, Fong.
Thanks, Annette. So we've been speaking to Annette Brownlee, founding member of Just Peace Queensland and current chairperson of IPAN. To learn more about Talisman Sabre, as well as register to attend the Pacific Peace Conference on Zoom, you can head to IPAN, that's IPAN.org.au, or head to our website after the show. And I'll hand it back over to Juliet and Caesar in the studio now.
This is the little single by Kian, a proud Yalanji Jirbal Badu Islander artist, released on Wednesday last week. This is Kian's new song, Heavy. You're listening to 3CR on 855 AM. That was Kian with a latest single called Heavy.
And yes, we're going to be passing over to Fung, who's calling in remotely to do our next interview.
Thanks, Juliet. Thanks, Visa. So we are now joined by Claire Hansen from the Save Public Housing Collective, who is here to give us an update on the situation concerning the demolition and destruction of public housing towers across Melbourne, the recent parliamentary inquiry, and the upcoming mass rally to save public housing, which is taking place Saturday this week on the 2nd of August. Thank you for joining us today, Claire.
Oh, it's always nice to be invited. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I was wondering if you could sum up what we've seen in the last few weeks regarding pre-demolition works across public towers in Melbourne, as well as the massive response that we've seen from individuals and community groups.
Well, I was a bit gobsmacked myself when I was doing some revision about the parliamentary inquiry that there are 806 separate submissions from individuals and groups like Safe Public Housing Collective undergoing investigation that are, you know, being scrutinised as we speak. 806, that's a lot of... what would you say? That's a lot of interest from the public, isn't it? It's not something little quiet little thing going on. And as far as that's their written submissions, and public hearings will begin next week, where people will be invited to speak at Parliament House. It's very hard getting answers about where the inquiry is at, because every time we try to, it's all slapped with, we don't have to tell you. Literally, that's how the Homes Victoria won the High Court, the Supreme Court case, class action that was taken by the residents at North Melbourne. They won by saying, we don't have to tell you our feasibility studies and blah, blah, blah. We had to tell them, but they didn't have to show their findings, which is extraordinary, considering that those towers belong to us.
Yeah, and we've seen that as a running theme, I think, in the last, in however long this fight's been happening, the lack of transparency and communication from the government and Homes Victoria. I wanted to, go into the parliamentary inquiry a bit. There's been clips, you know, being shared online of public housing residents speaking at the parliamentary inquiry. I was wondering if you could tell us more about the purpose of this inquiry and some of the statements and testimonies that we've seen that have been presented by both residents and lawyers who are representing these residents as well.
I'll be honest with you, I'm not as up to speed as I should be on having looked over everybody's various clips and testimonies. So, but if they are coming from a place in the community that we are coming from, then I can certainly tell you they are about people's, firstly, their right to choose where they live, the fact that they're their homes, they're not houses, these are homes and communities, the fact that the new buildings are appalling and no one wants to live in them. It's a little bit like banging your head against the wall, because they just keep telling us, as though we're dodos, that no, it will be better. We're building better. And they are really not. And we've actually seen that. We've seen the proof of what they're building in place of. And we've provided information, genuine feasibility studies about, you know, the towers in particular, if that's what we're talking about, are perfectly stable. There's absolutely no reason they should come down. As far as action down at the sites go, they have started, when I say they, I'm referring to Homes Victoria. They sent in the cavalry on Saturday morning to take soil samples and were met with people, residents and other concerned citizens, chained to equipment and I was unable to get down there, but I'm not entirely sure how far they got with their soil sampling because there was a massive pushback from people down there. It was very crowded. So, I mean, surely that means something to these people who were paid to represent us.
Yeah, well, I mean, what are your thoughts on that? Like, you were saying at the beginning there that you were gobsmacked at learning how many submissions there were to the inquiry and just, you know, we've all seen footage of, like you said, people gathering outside public housing in various suburbs across Melbourne, people chaining themselves to equipment. Why do you think we're seeing such a massive response from the broader community when it comes to saving public housing?
That's a good question, and I like it, because those people who, well, the people who don't live in public housing are the people who we really want to reach, and they have been pretty good in making their feelings about this known, because I don't think that anyone who doesn't live in public housing thinks much about it, because it's just there. It's just, there's not a person alive who hasn't grown up with the idea of public housing. It's what we do. We're a nice people. We're kind. We put out the safety net. And nobody thinks they're ever going to need that safety net. But I think it's becoming clear to people, that, especially with people living in cars and spending 80% of their entire income on mortgages or rent, I think people are starting to look at public housing now as a genuine, not just safety net, but possible way to go in the future as far as housing generally goes. And you know, that's the extreme left of me talking there. But I've lost my train of thought completely, Paul.
No, that's okay. I think I think I agree. I think you're right in that, you know, perhaps watching the reading about and learning about what's happening with the public housing in Victoria is really resonating with people, because it is sort of symbolic of the issues that people are experiencing at large when it comes to housing insecurity and the rise in rents and mortgages and even just, yeah, the pure lack of housing for people. And I listened to your conversation with Annie and Toby on Solidarity Breakfast over the weekend, and you clarified on their show the difference between public and social or community housing. I was wondering if you could share that difference in terms, in these terms, for our listeners again this morning.
Yeah, that's actually a conversation I am constantly having, and it's, I don't know if it's slowly sinking in, but there is a difference. We can't use the word social housing because it doesn't mean anything. It's just like saying social security, which is what the dole used to be called. Sorry, what's it called now?
Centrelink.
Yeah, Centrelink. Social security. So social housing means nothing. It's just a fluffy word to make people feel better. There are only two types of housing that we support, and that is public and not public. This wishy-washy bit in the middle, community housing, is absolutely evil, and that is what is happening now. Public housing is owned by us. I was about to say the government, but, you know, let's get real. The government don't own anything. It's ours. It belongs to the people of Victoria and Australia. And it is run by them, run by the government, managed by the government. They take the rents. They are our landlords, essentially. Community housing, on the other hand, is built by private contractors, are owned by private companies and managed by a third company, sometimes not even in Victoria. Evolve is a New South Wales company that managed the new community builds in Ascot Vale. They're not even in Victoria. How do you manage a place if you're not even here? And they take more rent. They have terrible leases that you have to keep applying for, incidentally. You get leases with end dates. If you get a three-year lease, you have to keep applying, and they can cherry-pick who they who they put into these places. So being desperate is not a a precursor to getting a place in public, in community housing, I beg your pardon. So community is run privately, public is run by us. I think that's the main difference, the only difference.
Yeah, thank you so much for that, Claire. I think a lot of the times we see words like social or community and we have hope that it represents or symbolises something that is going to be good for everyone. But so that's why I think it's really important that we that you help us better understand the difference in those terms. My last question for you this morning, Claire, is about the upcoming rally that's taking place on Saturday. You sort of alluded to this before, but why is it important for people to come on Saturday? And we're, you know, talking to people or talking about people who don't necessarily live in public housing or have a direct connection to it. How is it? How is this the responsibility of all of us? Yeah, and not just the people who are personally affected by the demolition.
Well, it's as responsibility of all of us because it's ours. We own it. Mm. You know, I wish there'd been this much pushback when they sold off the water, the public trust. No, sorry, not the water. The electricity, gas, and public house transport. Public transport. Now, there's a funny word. It's not public. We don't own it. So the reason it's important to attend or show some support is because it is ours. And like so much that is ours, it's being sold off publicly, privately. We are losing everything we own. So the rally is this Saturday and it's at 11 a.m. and we're meeting outside the State Library, on the steps of the State Library, 11 a.m. Saturday, where we will walk to 50 Lonsdale Street, which is the offices of Homes Victoria, and there'll be a few speakers there, and then we will finally end up at the steps of Parliament, where we'll have a couple of pollies who are, you know, fighting the good fight, speaking, and it's really important to have boots on the ground, getting thumbs up on, you know, signing petitions online is just, it's, means nothing. It means nothing. They barely look at it in Parliament. Thumbs ups mean nothing. Boots on the ground shows solidarity and support. They can't not see boots on the ground. So I would encourage everyone who cares, not just about the people who require public housing, but think about Melbourne's skyline if all of that goes. This will look nothing like the city we all grew up in.
Mm. Well, thank you so much for that, Claire. And, yeah, just for our listeners, we've been speaking to Claire Hansen from the Save Public Housing Collective. You can follow them on Instagram at Save Public Housing Collective, all one word. And just to reiterate Claire's message again, that the mass rally is this Saturday, the 2nd of August at 11 a.m. starting outside the State Library. You're listening to 3CR Community Radio, and I'll throw it back to Juliet and Frieza in the studio now.
Hi, this is Jessica.
And this is Daryl.
And we're from Breadline.
Breadline.
And we love listening to 3CR because...
We're on it.
No, because it's a community station.
Oh, yeah, that too.
Giving the voiceless a voice.
Voice. 3CR Community Radio, giving the voice to community since 1976.
Up next, we have an interview with S, one of the organisers of the Visit Palestine poster exhibition, which will be opening this Friday, the 1st of August. S joined me earlier this week to chat about the beginnings of the Visit Palestine poster project and how it came to be, as well as the role of the arts during these times we are in.
Hi, S. Thanks so much for joining us today. So, yeah, really excited about this Visit Palestine project that you have organized that's opening this Friday. I guess to start us off, could you tell us more about the global movement?
So this was started in 2021, so definitely before October 2023, by three folk. And it was kind of a spontaneous thing that happened. Started in Japan in an area called Koenji by... Matsumoto Hajime, Sako-san, and Andika Faisal. All three of these people actually run venues that are music venues.
Okay, yeah.
One's a record shop, one is a multi-purpose like music venue, and they all have strong, what's the word, maybe anarchist
kind of
strong political beliefs. I mean political. But yeah, so 2021 in June, Matsumoto Hajime actually had a couple of these resistance posters from Palestine.
Okay.
I don't know exactly where he got them from, but they're from his personal collection. And then the three of them kind of got together, photographed them, did their research, put together a little booklet, and then had their first exhibition in May of 2022. So that's kind of where the original exhibition started. Then later on, another poster contributor, whose name is Misako Nagasawa, who is a researcher in Middle Eastern culture, actually has her own collection, and her own collection is even bigger. I think it's 300 plus. I'm not too certain on that number, but I remember reading it in one of the booklets that they put together. She got her collection actually from an artist who's no longer with us, Toshio Sato, who was given the posters, I don't know, maybe 30 years ago by the Palestinian delegation that was going to Japan, because Japan used to have a Palestinian embassy.
Okay,
so they brought over all of these posters, and then Sato-san was holding onto them, and as he was getting older and it was time to like pass them on, Misako-san took them, she photographed them, she categorized them, and then part of these images, not the actual posters, were sent to Dan Walsh, who used to be a missionary, I believe, who's traveled to the Middle East a number of times. And he runs Palestine Poster Project online, where he has collected all of these like posters
from all the different
from not just Palestine but from Swan area, specifically in resistance, in calling for liberation, in self-autonomy, like political posters that call for action. So now Misako-san has her own section on this website of the posters that she has, so they are cataloged somewhere, and the whole point of this cataloging is that they want this to become part of the UNESCO memory. So that's kind of how it started. That's how the posters came to them. And then from there, they just kept going. And so then it traveled through Japan, a bunch of cities, and then in Taiwan most recently, and Hong Kong, and now here.
Yeah, incredible.
And hopefully in the future, other
places. And it's traveling on,
So the whole point of this exhibition, not just here in so-called Australia, but throughout its movement, is that movement.
For it to move as well. That's amazing.
For it to be continual. Like, this obviously these posters obviously focus predominantly on Palestinian liberation, but yeah, it's the continual movement to tell the story that this is a 77 plus year struggle, and that this has been going on long before we came to the cause, and that it will go on until all oppressed peoples are free.
I love that. I love that it's the movement of the posters as a goal of the movement in itself. I think that's incredible. And like it's a living exhibition. It shows that the ongoing nature of this work. I think that's great. Could you say a bit more about, I guess, that, so obviously we will be having this exhibition this Friday at Black Spark Cultural Centre. You've spoken about the history of it, but what about the goals of this exhibition in particular, like the curation you've done for this specific exhibition coming up?
So I came across these posters when I was in Japan last year, 2024. I was there for work, but I am very familiar with Substore. So Andy is like the main organizer of the global project. So he's my main contact. And I saw versions of these posters, not versions, different iterations. And was like, what do you mean these are from Palestine? He's like, there's like a collection. And we've shown them everywhere. And there was a booklet. And I was like, what do you mean? What do you mean? And how can I? And so after coming back to so-called Australia and just being like, hello, hi, can we bring here?
Yeah.
And Andy is, of course. And I was like, Andy and I didn't know each other extensively. You know, we had face-to-face interactions. Because again, Substore, the space that he runs, is a little bit is a little bit kind of like Black Spark. They have exhibitions.
Okay, yeah. They have, so it's a cultural center, yes.
And he was gracious enough to say yes, of course. Like, he obviously he wants the posters to travel, and if anybody is keen to, like, undertake that, then he was happy to work with me on that. And so he selected 15 posters, so that's currently what we have.
Okay.
Which is still a big number. But I kind of came to him with, I would like clear resistance posters with a call to armed resistance. That's my personal belief. I believe in armed resistance, especially of oppressed people.
Yeah.
And by 2024, we thought we had seen all of the horror that we could possibly see. Obviously, that's not true. We are here today in 2025 in July, and it's still worse than we could have imagined.
Yeah.
And I just feel like that sometimes we know that armed resistance is necessary, but a lot of people shy away from those conversations. They shy away from acknowledging it. They try and skirt around it. And I think, as we've witnessed over and over again, this is what the Palestinian people have been asking for.
Yeah.
And I think it deserves respect and acknowledgement and serious, serious contemplation.
Yeah.
Serious contemplation. And so these posters are sometimes, you know, as we were framing them, it was like, you see them once you unpack them.
Yeah.
You see them in the photos. I saw them in the photos.
Yeah.
And then I saw them once we were unpacking them.
Yeah.
And you hold them. Yes. And there's yellowing or tears.
And you know it's from Palestine.
So there's like certain ones were printed in Palestine. Yeah. Some were printed in different locations, but they all come from the PLO.
That's the story, the heritage that's carried within those paper itself.
Yes. And some of them were like had international artists contribute, and some were like definitely with unknown artists. Once we were framing them, it was just even more like they take over you. They take over you in a way that like just requires you to just stop for a moment and just sit with this, like,
listen to these stories that's coming up.
Listen to these stories and sit with these feelings and observe the tears. Like, I think that's one of the things that really kind of hits me the most. And when I was writing the foreword for the booklet, the fragilities of these posters and the fragility of us as humans was just so parallel in my eyes. And some of these posters have survived 30 years. And we've been, like, and the Palestinian people have been fighting for 77 plus years.
Yeah.
So, like, there's a weight to that.
Yes. Yeah, that is the responsibility to pause, to give it the time and attention and love that it deserves.
Exactly. So when I say that this exhibition isn't like a light waltz through posters, because they have beautiful
of
posters
course,
as well.
Yeah. And they still there's speak the aesthetics. To yeah, exactly.
And they still speak to resistance.
Yeah.
But I was very keen on having posters that were, for lack of a better word, in your face.
Art has always featured so heavily in movements, in resistance movements across histories, across societies.
Yeah.
What do you think is the role of art in resistance? Like, it keeps coming up. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, so this is a really good question, but also a very difficult question as somebody who has worked in the quote-unquote creative industry for almost 10 plus years at this point, and always being deeply unsatisfied and deeply distrusting, just because you can see once you're in it how much advantage is being taken of the artist.
The exploitation,
yes. And I think as a culture and as art has become an industry and less of a craft, there's this like thing of just making art for art's sake. And I think there is a room for that 100%.
Absolutely.
But in this day and age,
in this time,
in this point,
the times
in time,
we are in.
Yeah. I think I said this to a friend yesterday, you're a conduit of the times.
Yes.
It is your responsibility as an artist.
Yeah.
To represent what is happening now.
Yeah.
And to have that piece of art be a point of contemplation, discomfort,
yes,
change,
yes,
action. I have always had this opinion about art. Mm. I personally prefer art that challenges me and
beautiful
moves,
yeah,
me. Being part of social media coming along.
Mm.
And this is part of a bigger thing of like everybody wanting to like do art and be creative, which I 100% condone.
We should all do it, yes.
We are humans. We were, yes, created. Our whole purpose
we
is
create.
To create.
Exactly.
So...
Yeah. Yeah.
I want everybody to create and be an artist and all that stuff. But it has turned into an industry. It has turned into a brand. It has turned into monopolization of like you as a human, as like this fun, comfortable thing.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
social media has only exacerbated that. So it's a very difficult thing. So
yeah.
in this sense, and knowing that a lot of Palestine specifically, but also a lot of the other Levant and Swahana countries
region.
And even in Africa.
Yes.
A lot of places that have suffered oppression have really strong history of a political
art making, yes.
as a form
yes.
of yeah. resistance.
And it's together, right? Like literally
yes.
the very act of continuing to create is an act of resistance.
Exactly.
And
they've taken your voice.
Yes, exactly.
And they've taken
yeah.
your words and they've taken your platforms. But what they couldn't take from you was the random poster that you stuck
yes.
up on somewhere that
your
says
ability
Viva
to
Palestina.
Create. Yeah.
That
yeah.
poster that somehow made its way out of Algeria and has somehow ended up in Europe that calls
yes.
for the liberation
Absolutely.
Of the oppressed
people. All oppressed
people, like,
yeah.
All of these things are in that context is, like you said, creation is a form of resistance because that's what they want to take from you.
Yeah.
And the kind of creation that they want from you is this lovely go
yeah, toes the line, yeah. Upholds the status quo.
That looks
yeah.
wonderful in your yeah. apartment that you just
True,
walk
yeah.
past and
that
you
sells.
Never look at again.
Yeah, yeah.
Instead of something that's within your space, within your eye line,
yeah.
that holds you, that stops you
in
your tracks.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I answered that correctly.
No, there is no correct. No, that was
and
beautiful.
A lot of
this yeah.
is obviously
yeah.
personal, and I'm sure everybody has different opinions, but as an artist in this day and age, to not be a conduit of your times,
yeah.
to share something that, like, how many freaking words have we said? What
yeah.
have we not said that all oppressed people since the start of time
have, been
have
saying,
not been
exactly.
saying?
Yes.
So
yes.
having art, which
yes.
is this thing that doesn't require language and hits everybody differently
yeah.
and hits
yeah.
you differently on a different day and when
yeah.
you see this color evokes
yes.
the power of it is not to be taken lightly. And I think
yeah.
with the institutionalization and making art an industry, all of that power is gone. And artists who don't comply with that are not part of it and they... you know,
struggle
for.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, perhaps to wrap it up, we could share more about the exhibition, what's coming up. I hear there's potentially a workshop as well that people could participate in. Could you share more details about the when and where?
Yes, so the opening is August 1st at
yes.
Black Spark.
Yeah.
You can get tickets online, and or if you forget to buy tickets or just want to come and pay at the door, that's also going to be an option. And it would be devastating to me to have people wanting to see this exhibition but they couldn't afford the ticket price.
Yeah.
So no one will be turned away.
Beautiful.
Everyone's welcome.
Yeah.
So definitely show up on the night at the door. No point holding something like this if we can't raise funds to redistribute to people who need it. And in my opinion at the moment, that's obviously Palestinian Mutual Aid, First Nations Mutual Aid always,
yes.
because we are on stolen land.
Absolutely.
The struggle is united, and Sudan as well, which needs
Beautiful.
All of our support.
Yeah.
Opening 6:30 till about 10 p.m. Andy and I are doing an interview as well, and
okay.
so we'll be screening the interview. Sadly,
Beautiful.
Andy can't make it to the opening.
Yeah.
And the workshop, yes. So
yeah.
I made DIY lino patches. Again, for me, that's a form of just having something on you that just lets people
yeah.
look at it and be like, hey, think about it. And
yeah.
I think... it would be a great opportunity to sit in the space with those posters and individuals to create their own lino patches.
Beautiful.
That's going to be on the 9th of August. Yeah, so it would be an honor to have people show up and actually just sit in the space, absorb
yes.
the posters,
yes.
then create some lino patches that reflect that.
We've been listening to an interview with S, an organizer of the Visit Palestine poster exhibition, which will be held at Black Spark Cultural Center from the 1st to the 17th of August. The opening night this Friday will also be a fundraiser for Palestine, First Nations and Sudan Mutual Aid. The Lino Patch workshop will be held on the 9th of August, and more information can be seen on Instagram via @black.spark_. The link for opening night and the workshop tickets, as well as contact details for those who might be interested to bring these posters to their city, will be up on the 3CR Tuesday Breakfast post for today.
Up next, we have Fleur Taylor from the Save Our Pool campaign in Banyul. This June, Banyul Council voted to close the Olympic Leisure Centre pool in Heidelberg West. And in the lead up to this decision, the community banded together to fight for their aquatic centre and put pressure on the council to reverse the decision. And Fleur is here today to chat about the importance of community pools, particularly in light of National Drowning Day, which occurred last week on July 25th. Thanks for joining us on Tuesday Breakfast, Fleur.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, good morning. We're excited to have you on the show today, Fleur. To start off, can you tell us a little bit about the Olympic Leisure Centre pool in Heidelberg West and what it means to the community?
Well, it's a pool that was, constructed in the 1970s, like a lot of pools around Australia were. And it's a pool that's been subject to a number of community consultations, often facilitated by the council, including a big co-design process that happened sort of over in 2020 to 22. Time and time again, the community has told the council how important the pool is to them, how important it is to have aquatic facilities that are within walking distance, that have been made culturally safe for a range of different communities in the area. And I think that's what has made the recent decision by the council to close the pool with, in a really shock sort of decision. So appalling, because it's flying in the face of, really clearly stated community visions and community wishes in the Olympic Village, West Heidelberg area for the leisure centre.
Yeah, that sounds, all very concerning, particularly, you mentioned that, the pool provides so many important community services. Could you speak to some of the programs that the pool offers and, the groups who benefit from them?
Well, it has aquaerobics sessions, and a hydrotherapy space where people who are recovering from injury or perhaps are elderly or needing to sort of maintain physical fitness or recover from injury in different ways access. It also has, just a regular swimming pool, and it has a gym there as well. One of the sticking points for the community has been that it used to have like a kids pool, but that's been sort of closed off for years. And I guess there's a concern that, despite multiple reports going to the council over dating back, more than a decade, detailing the amount of support and repair needed to maintain the pool to an acceptable standard and maintain it as a community facility, it has been allowed to run down. I think one of the most noteworthy things that the pool currently offers, which currently has no alternative offered yet by the council, is that it has a women's only session on Friday nights, which isn't just about swimming. It's about social, physical and mental health. It's widely used by Muslim women in the community and from beyond the Banyul community, for a women's only space where people use the sauna, use the hydrotherapy pool, swim, use the gym, but also connect with each other at a social level, away from the kids, away from the pressures of daily life. And that's probably one of the most distressing things about, this sudden decision to close the pool, which is, currently slated for October.
Yeah, definitely. I think, that point about the pool being more than just a place for physical activity, but for, maintaining the social and mental well-being of the community. There are so many important aspects that the pool provides. And, Yeah, I was reading about how, you know, some of the reasons that they've posed for closing the pool was about the numbers of people attending. And yeah, it does sound like with the children's pool being closed for a long time, that would really limit the user groups who can actually use the pool and what sort of programs can be run.
Well, I think as well that you know, I mean, as we all know, like statistics can be sort of cut many different ways, can't they? And so, you know, if they only survey people who have a membership that's based at that pool, you know, they might not be catching all the people who use it regularly but don't have a membership, or have a membership, you know, that's based at another aquatic centre but allows them to use this facility, you know, or people who use it, you know, casually but are not sort of registered there and so forth. But I think, you know, your point is valid as well, that like if you make a facility sort of harder to use and don't put the funding into it, and I think, you know, the West Heidelberg community is, you know, unfortunately seeing that happen in a lot of, you know, different spaces, you know, in this area, you know, then you kind of bring about the sort of you know, the outcome that you were angling for anyway. And I
yeah.
think that's the issue, where we feel like the more that we dig, the more that we sort of ask questions at council, the more that we talk to local residents, the more that we go around with our petitions and you know, talk to people, like the more it comes out about, you know, the broken promises and the mismanagement and the sort of mixed messages that people have been getting about this facility and other facilities.
Yeah, definitely. And yeah, so last week was National Drowning Day. Could you speak a little bit, Fleur, as to, you know, why having a pool is really important in relation to, you know, community safety and drownings?
Yeah, well, I mean, as listeners would be aware, there's been a surge in fatal drownings in Australia over the last few summers and at other times during the year. And it is noteworthy that some of these, you know, that many of the people that have tragically drowned have been from migrant communities or communities where, you know, learning to swim or having those swimming skills from childhood hasn't been, you know, something that's been part of their culture in the same way as it has if you've grown up from a kid here in Australia. And so given that West Heidelberg area has something like 46% of households where both families are from, born overseas, and particularly we also have in our community almost double the number of households that don't have a car compared to the rest of Banyule. So having a facility where people can learn to swim, where people can be safely in the water, you know, within walking distance of their homes, is critically important. And so, like, our key focus at the moment is, you know, that we object to the council closing this pool with so little notice and so little voice for the community. A whole group of women came to speak at the last council meeting and were, you know, basically shut out of the process. They wanted to share their experiences of how important the Friday night swimming is for them. And so our key demand at the moment is that the council has to slow down this process. You know, maybe it is the case that the swimming pool was too far gone and something else, you know, needs to be built to accommodate the needs of this community. But at the very least, they need to, like, why would you close a pool in the face of rising drowning rates and all of the issues that we've mentioned? Why would you close a pool before summer? Wouldn't you keep it open, you know, for at least one more summer and let people have that that ability and properly consult with people about what the future is of aquatic facilities in West Heidelberg?
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, you've spoken, Fleur, about what some of those demands are that the community has. What are the steps that the campaign's going to be taking in the months ahead to, yeah, continue to put
yeah,
that
well,
pressure
we're
on?
We're going to be attending and protesting outside and asking questions inside every single council meeting, you know, until further notice, until we get action on these points. So the next council meeting is to be held at the Heidelberg Town Hall, which is in Upper Heidelberg Road, Ivanhoe, on Monday the 4th of August. So our rally will take place from 6 p.m. And then we will attend the council meeting and you know, probe further into the issues via our right, our democratic right to ask questions of our elected representatives from 7 o'clock onwards. Every Saturday from 11 o'clock, we're outside the Olympic Leisure Centre itself, which can be found on Southern Road in West Heidelberg. And you can come and join us there and, you know, especially call out to anyone who's the resident of Banyule and or a user of the Olympic Leisure Centre pool to come and join us in the campaign and look for our group on Facebook, Save Our Pool 3081.
Yeah, awesome. Well, that's actually exactly what I was going to ask you, was how our listeners can find out more. So really appreciate you sharing all of that, Fleur. And yeah, thanks so much for coming on and chatting about, you know, the importance of your community pool and, you know, what you're doing to fight for it.
Thank you very much for having us on, and all strength to the many other campaigns that are taking place, you know, across Victoria and nationally to save infrastructure like pools. We know we're just one of many communities that is facing these issues.
Yeah, well, thank you so much, Fleur. And, yeah, we've been speaking to Fleur Taylor from the Save Our Pool campaign about the community effort to reverse the decision to close the Olympic Leisure Centre pool in Heidelberg West. And we also spoke about the importance of community aquatic centres. And on the theme of pools, we're now going to listen to Aqua Profunda, which is a song by Courtney Barnett from 2015 from her album Sometimes I Sit and Think and Sometimes I Just Sit. And this is about the Fitzroy Pool, which had a successful campaign to save it in the 90s. Listening to Tuesday Breakfast, and that was Aqua Profunda by Courtney Barnett from the album Sometimes I Sit and Think and Sometimes I Just Sit. What a title. And up next, we're speaking to Jeanne Dodd, who is a proud Gungaru, Biddy, Widdy and Kanju woman from central Queensland. Jeanne has helped establish the Yumba Balbara Badi camp to resist the Gemini coal mine by Magnetic South RSL. And Jeanne is here to talk about the threat of that mine and how Gungaru people are standing up to protect country and challenge the ongoing and proposed destruction of mining companies. Welcome to Tuesday Breakfast, Jeanne.
Hello, thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, thank you so much for getting up early and making time to chat to us. Yeah, you mentioned to me yesterday that you've just come back from the camp at Yumba Balbara. Can you speak a little bit about, you know, what's happening on the ground at the camp and what your role was in establishing it?
Yeah, for sure. The camp's out at Dingo, and that's in central Queensland, obviously, about
an hour and a half, 2 hours out of Rockhampton in that main area. And so Yumba Balbari means many rivers on our country, many homelands. And so the rivers and waterways are really important there. And so is all the ecological systems that currently exist. And so the issue that's happening right now is that Magnetic South have a proposed mine, Gemini Mine, and they've already started illegally clearing land. And so out there at the moment, we have our ceremonial fire burning. That's been burning now. I believe we're on day 28, so close to a month. And so we're keeping that ceremonial fire burning because we're practicing culture out on country as per our right under the Queensland Human Rights Act, Section 28. And so we're there as protectors of country. That's a part of our cultural duty to ensure that the endangered animals that are in those sites that they're clearing are protected, to ensure that we're really upholding our cultural law. And my role in all of this, I suppose, is I follow the advice of my elders and older cousins. I head out to camp where I can between my work, so really prioritising that. And I've also been the one to engage our lawyers as well and seek legal advice on what we can do.
Yeah, no, it sounds like you've been really busy, you know, doing so many really important things out there. And, yeah, one thing that I was reading about was how, you know, setting up the camp is a form of reoccupation and reclamation for Gungurru people. Could you talk us through a little bit of, you know, what that means to you?
Yeah, of course. So for us as Gungurru people, I suppose, it is about us coming home. It's about returning home. So, you know, when we're born, we're born from our countries, and when we die, we return to our countries. And in that meantime, a part of our mithara, part of our spirit exists in our country. And so we need to return home to feel full, to feel whole, to feel connected, and to really understand ourselves. And country and our identity is so deeply intertwined. So going back home for us, I think, oh gosh, like it has been the most unreal experience for us, just sitting on country and doing what our old people did. We think about all the ancestors and countrymen that come before us, and when we're sitting there and we're observing the Gundaloo, the emus that come to our camp with their chicks, and we use our emu caller to draw them in, and observing the birds, all the woods that we have there. We have rosewood in that area, which is the toughest weaponry wood for us, and that's our economy. So really understanding the land. And a lot of people say a lot of this stuff was lost upon colonisation, but I always say that it's just been put to sleep, and country has those stories that have been put to sleep. So if you go out and sit there like we're doing now and reclaiming that space and that site and returning home, then you can awaken those stories that have been put to sleep for sometimes hundreds of years.
Yeah, it really sounds like, you know, you're tapping into that, those stories and that history by being on country and, you know, really engaging with the environment. And yeah, can you speak a little bit more about, you know, what is the destruction that's already been done by the mining company at the site of the proposed mine, and what else are they saying that they're going to do?
Yeah, of course. So there's been a massive section of land already cleared, and we can hear when we're at camp the machinery going. So we know when there's clearing, you can feel those trees hit the ground. One of my elders said she can actually hear like the trees crying and being sad as well. So they've already cleared quite a massive amount. We have photos of that and footage of that as well. Every time I head back out to camp, more has been cleared, unfortunately. I know that Magnetic South has come out and said that they've not done anything wrong. However, it's obviously that's obviously not correct. What they're doing currently is very different from what they originally proposed and what was originally approved. So that's some issues that we're looking at there. We really want the federal government to step in and intervene and make some changes as well, so that we can actually put a stop to this mine, especially in these spaces where there's endangered animals like the bridled nail-tail wallaby, which we've seen. He's endangered. We've seen the sugar gliders that are endangered. And so we really don't want them to keep developing and setting up camp for their mine there. So yeah, it's mainly land clearing at the moment, but we know if we don't stop it now, it's just going to snowball and get quicker and worse.
Yeah, and I think, you know, that impact is only going to be, you know, more devastating, you know, if the mine is, you know, fully realised and built on the site. And yeah, what are some, so yeah, you spoke to, you know, wanting the government to step in and, you know, try to stop the mine. What are some of the demands of you and your Gunguru community that you're calling for moving forward?
Yeah, of course. So we're calling for the mine to be stopped. I mean, the ultimate goal for us is for that mine not to take place there. There's too much ecological significance, there's too much cultural significance in these spaces. So obviously that really high top-tier demand is to have that mine stopped and not done there. On our country already, if you, you know, Google Blackwater or if you look at Central Queensland region, you can see how many mines already exist on our country. So we're saying to the government, please don't make this space another line of, you know, another highway line with a lot of mines. That's not what we want. The next demand, if that's not possible, we really want those endangered species looked after, removed to a safer area, looked at to be protected. But also the demand from us comes on our waterways as well. A lot of our rivers and creeks from Blackdown and around the area that's proposed to be mined feeds into all the other river systems right down south to you guys. So we don't want those destroyed or destructed either. So those are our top tier demands. Is please intervene. Please stop letting illegal happenings happen on our country from mines.
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, it's so scary, just as you've outlined, you know, that impact of, you know, not only building the mine, but then, you know, if it was actually there, you know, that impact flows on, you know, through the rivers to so many other places as well. And yeah, it sounds like, you know, there's so many important considerations that we need to have be thinking about moving forward. But yeah, how can our listeners here at 3CR support and stand in solidarity with the Gunguru community in the fight against the mine?
Yeah, for sure. There's lots of ways that people can help. So we have social pages. So you can follow us on Instagram, follow us on Facebook, follow us on TikTok. We also have an email, so please feel free to email us if you want to come visit us at Yamba Balbarabari. You're more than welcome to come sit around our fire. At a more, sort of official or government level, we would love for people to write to their local members to really put public pressure on this issue. Write to who you can, saying that you want the federal government to intervene to stop this, because the government has come out and said that it needs to be reviewed. They know that. But we need more public pressure for them to act quicker.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, you know, that's such a powerful thing to be doing as well, is, you know, getting in touch, as you said, with your MPs and, you know, raising those alarm bells. And, we'll also encourage our listeners to follow the Instagram page and, get in touch if they, can, you know, come and support in person as well. We really appreciate you coming on the show today, Jeanne. Do you have any final, things you want to share before we wrap up?
No, but I probably the only thing is I'm actually down in Nam from this Thursday until next Wednesday. So if there is anybody who wants to hear more about the work we're doing or think that they can help partner with us or anything like that, like I'm super keen to have that yarn. But look, if there's any Gunguru people listening or any mob listening who do want to, you know, have the time to want to come and help us, maintain that fire, please reach out. You're more than welcome to come camp with us. It takes a community, not just, you know, a handful of people. So the more support, the better. And just thank you so much for platforming this and giving a voice to something that sometimes falls to the wayside.
Yeah, definitely. Well, no, we really appreciate you coming on and, talking about all the really important work that you've been doing, you know, protecting country and, raising that awareness of, you know, why, you know, we do need to stand up to these, you know, mining corporations. Mm-hmm. So we really appreciate all your time, Jeanne. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I really, really appreciate it. You have a lovely day.
You too. Well, we've been speaking to Jeanne Dodd about her role in establishing the Yamba Balbarabari camp to resist the proposed Gemini coal mine in central Queensland. You can follow their Instagram account at Yamba_Balbarabari on Instagram to find out more about the camp and to support their campaign to resist against the Gemini coal mine.
Incredible. What a great lineup we've had today. I absolutely love the topics we've covered. But before we wrap up, just a couple of events coming up this week, Juliet, maybe you'd share with our listeners.
Yeah, so tomorrow, Wednesday, the 30th of July at 9:30 on the steps of Parliament, there's going to be a snap rally for Bail Saves Lives. So you can join the Victorian Aboriginal Legal Service, VALS, Flat Out, and the Human Rights Law Centre, as well as others, to take a stand against Victoria's dangerous bail laws that will harm Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. Join the rally and call on the Allan government to abandon these harmful laws.
Absolutely. And of course, this Saturday as well, on the 2nd of August, would be the mass rally to save public housing. That would be from the State Library of Victoria. Well, I'm afraid that's all we have on the show for today. To wrap up, we started at 7:15 a.m. with Annette Brownlee, founding member of the Brisbane-based community peace organisation Just Peace Queensland and current chairperson of IPAN, speaking about the Talisman Sabre war exercises as well as the Pacific Peace Conference. At 7:30, we were joined by Claire Hansen, speaking about the Safe Public Housing Collective, an update on the situation concerning the demolition and destruction of public housing towers across Melbourne. At 7:45, we listened to an interview with S about the Visit Palestine poster exhibition, which will be opening this Friday, the 1st of August, at the Black Spark Cultural Centre.
And then we spoke to Fleur Taylor at 8 a.m. about the Save Our Pool campaign in Banyul, which is fighting to save the Olympic Leisure Centre pool in Heidelberg West. We also spoke about the importance of community pools in creating a place to learn about public safety and also to form social bonds and protect mental well-being. And then finally at 8:15, we spoke to Jeanne Dodd, who's a proud Gungru, Biddy, Widdy and Kanju woman from Central Queensland, who established the Yumba Balbara Badi camp to resist the Gemini coal mine by Magnetic South in Central Queensland.
Incredible. You're listening to 3CR Breakfast on Tuesday, the 29th of July. And please stay tuned for more incredible programming to come up. Goodbye.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find NIBS opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall, Carlton. Keep up to date with upcoming events at nibs.org.au.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.